From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, French fury over claims the National Security Agency has been spying on millions of the nation's phone calls. Legally yours, New Jersey gives gay marriage the green light.
I now, by the power vested in me, thank God, by the state of New Jersey, it's about time, I declare Joseph and Orville to be lawful spouses in the state of New Jersey.
We head to San Francisco for the latest on the transit strike after two BART workers are killed. And we hear the shocking case of the human guinea pigs of 1950s New York.
The level of risk that these men were exposed to goes beyond any reasonable standard that we would allow research volunteers to participate in.
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama is defending the rollout of new marketplaces to buy health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. The law, passed back in 2009, requires all Americans to purchase health insurance, but the online systems to do so have been difficult to use. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has more.
On October 1st, the online marketplaces were launched to allow Americans to shop for health care insurance. Only the websites don't work well, especially the main one from the U.S. government, healthcare.gov. U.S. President Barack Obama is frustrated. The rollout of the main component of his historic Affordable Care Act has gone badly.
And there's no excuse for the problems. And these problems are getting fixed.
The Republicans have pounced on the problem, saying the technology problems cannot be solved. The law itself is a disaster. The Obama administration says the problems are actually a sign of success. The systems are overloaded because so many Americans want to sign up. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
Whistleblower Edward Snowden's leaking of classified U.S. National Security Agency spy programs is now causing tension between the United States and Mexico. This latest round of controversy comes after the German weekly Der Spiegel published an article revealing how the U.S. gained access to ex-president Felipe Calderón's private emails. Latin America correspondent Andrea Arenas reports.
According to the latest documents leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, in 2010, the U.S. National Security Agency ran an operation called Flat Liquid that gave them access to former Mexican President Felipe Calderón's email. The U.S. accessed these private presidential documents by hacking into a key email server in the Mexican presidential domain. Mexico's foreign minister has condemned the U.S. agency's actions, calling the practice unacceptable, illegal, and against Mexican international law. Andrea Arenas, Washington.
The U.K. government has given the green light for the country's first nuclear power station in a generation. The $22 billion scheme will be delivered by an international consortium led by French firm EDF and containing Chinese investors. FSN's Ollie Barrett reports from London.
Hinkley Point C plant will be built in Somerset in southwest England. Ministers say it will be operational by 2023, create 25,000 jobs, and help secure lower cost, low carbon power for around 60 years. EDF leads the consortium, which will include Chinese investors. This after Chancellor George Osborne signed a memorandum of understanding with China last week, which could see the country become majority stakeholder in future nuclear projects in the UK. Ollie Barrett, London.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. An explosion on a bus in Volgograd in southern Russia took the life of six passengers and one suspected suicide bomber. 33 injured were taken to the city's hospitals. The investigators believe a female terrorist, a native of the Restive Republic of Dagestan, could be responsible for the attack. Daria Bondarchuk reports from our Moscow bureau.
A bomb exploded in a bus around 2 o'clock in the afternoon local time. There were some 40 passengers on board, among them young people and children. 32 were injured, including 1-year-and-a-half-old toddler. The spokesman of the Russian Investigative Committee said the attack is believed to have been carried out by a 30-year-old woman from the Russian Republic of Dagestan in the rest of North Caucasus region. According to preliminary information, the suspect, Naida Hialova, was a resident of Makhachkala, a city in southern Russia. She has recently converted to Islam and was a wife of a Dagestani militant leader, investigators said. According to witnesses' reports, the explosion took place almost immediately after the woman boarded the bus. Дарья Бондарчук, Moscow.
And New Jersey Governor Chris Christie announced that his administration will drop its appeal to the state Supreme Court's ruling that allows for same-sex marriages. The announcement came hours after same-sex weddings began in the state. Ira Spitzer has more from New York.
The final hurdle to same-sex marriage in the state of New Jersey appears to have been cleared with Christie's announcement. The first couples were married just after midnight on Monday morning, as allowed by the state Supreme Court ruling. The governor's decision to withdraw his appeal is a reversal from his earlier position that the issue should be decided by New Jersey voters, not the state's highest court. The state court ruled in September that denying same-sex couples the right to marry was a violation of rights granted to them in June by the federal Supreme Court. 14 states in the District of Columbia currently allow same-sex couples to marry. Ira Spitzer, New York.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. After months of negotiations behind closed doors, the U.S. Justice Department and J.P. Morgan Chase reached a tentative agreement over the weekend that would force the powerful bank to pay about $13 billion to settle claims that it misled investors about the value and safety of its mortgage bonds. In Washington, D.C., Alice Ulstein has the details.
The settlement reached Friday night and still being finalized would be the largest paid to the government in U.S. history. And at $13 billion would constitute more than half of what the bank earned last year. On a conference call earlier this month, CEO Jamie Dimon vented his frustration about the deal.
I mean, obviously, it's very painful, okay, for me personally, because I agree with you. I don't like losing money, obviously, for my shareholders.
Bloomberg News reports that $9 billion of the settlement would go to the government in payments and fines, while $4 billion would go toward relief for homeowners hurt by the mortgage scheme. But economics professor Gerald Epstein at the University of Massachusetts said that in other recent bank settlements, the money did not make it to the people who needed it most, those who lost their homes to foreclosure or are underwater on their mortgages.
In the past, the amounts per homeowner have been way too small. If homeowners have lost their houses, several hundred thousands of dollars, the settlements have been for something like $20,000, which for many homeowners has just been a drop in the bucket. The second problem is that a lot of the money has actually gone to the brokers, lawyers, other middle people, and very little has trickled down to the homeowners themselves. And finally, there are all kinds of homeowners who can't prove that they were the subject of fraud, but in fact were caught up in the overall financial crisis, which was generated by banks like J.P. Morgan. And so one doesn't know yet if there are real safeguards this time around so that this will be more effective.
Also still unknown is whether J.P. Morgan will be allowed to write off the settlement on its taxes this spring, a common hidden feature of many past agreements between the government and corporations charged with wrongdoing. If this emerging deal follows the pattern of the Obama administration's deals with BP, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo, the public will end up subsidizing the company's legal penalties. But unlike most major settlements with banks over the past few years, the Justice Department is reportedly not giving J.P. Morgan immunity from criminal liability, meaning investigations into the bank's practices will continue, and more lawsuits could be filed by the federal government, states, or individuals in the future. And that's just on the issue of risky or fraudulent mortgage lending. The company also faces a number of investigations around the world, from bribery in China to interest rate manipulation in the UK. CEO Jamie Dimon told reporters and investors this month that he's actively working on negotiating these charges down.
It's very hard. We've got top people involved inside and outside the company, and hopefully over time we will make this a much smaller issue.
The dollar amount of the not-yet-signed agreement with the Justice Department is already being described by economists and the mainstream media as historic. Yet the possible $13 billion penalty comes from charges that J.P. Morgan knowingly made false statements and withheld information when selling $33 billion worth of mortgage bonds to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
The public is supposed to be made to believe that because the number sounds large, and you can say it's the largest one to date, that it represents a punishment that fits the crime. I don't think it comes anywhere near it.
That's Richard Wolff, a visiting economics and international affairs professor at the New School University in New York City. He called this tentative settlement window dressing.
The mortgage business for J.P. Morgan operated for many, many years. It generated way more than $13 billion. You have to do something a bit bigger than you used to because the government has been attacked by the mass of the American people for playing games with these bankers rather than controlling them. And here's the most important point. Nothing has been done to fundamentally alter what the banks do and how they do it.
With the majority of the regulations in the 2010 Dodd-Frank financial reform law still not implemented, many lawmakers and grassroots organizations continue to call for stricter oversight of Wall Street. While some are advocating for massive financial institutions like J.P. Morgan to be broken up into smaller, less risky companies. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Once again, the NSA stands accused of taking its surveillance practices overseas. This time it's France in the firing line. The accusations state that millions of telephone calls, including those of officials and businesses, were spied on by the American agency. Le Monde, the French newspaper who ran the story, based the allegations on documents leaked by Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor. Earlier, I asked Amy Stepanovich from Washington's Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, if these latest revelations came as any surprise.
I think this is just yet another demonstration of how broad the NSA has interpreted its legal authority and why we need to start looking at major reforms in this country and possibly in other countries under surveillance authorities to make sure that we're not all spying on one another for no reason.
Isn't this simply a case of everyone's doing it, so why shouldn't we when it comes to the U.S. intelligence activities?
At some point, somebody has to stop. Somebody has to take their finger off the trigger. And when you look at who this spying is targeting and where we're getting information from, we're not really looking at protecting national security interests or keeping terrorists out. So there's no real reason for these practices to be engaged in. And I think it's time that we step down from monitoring our allies and our friends and try to see what we're really trying to accomplish here.
Governments have always snooped and spied upon one another, but these latest revelations regarding the quantities and the capabilities, surely this is just because of the technological advances. You use what materials are at your disposal, or you get left behind.
You know, the manner has changed, yes, but the manner has, by effect, changed the volume. We're now collecting, because we have the capabilities and because we're able to do this over the internet largely, or over the wires, and we have much advanced technology, we're collecting a massive amount of information, much more than we've ever collected before. And that information is more revealing than it ever has been before, and it's more personal, it's more individualized. So there's, yes, it might be an extension of prior activities, and I'm not going to say that those are right either. I think that if we start from a position where all surveillance was proper before, we end up in a bad spot. But right now, it definitely is no longer proper.
We had recently the head of the NSA saying that you need a haystack to find a needle. Hence these vast collections, this huge net of information. Does he have a point?
I mean, again and again, we're seeing that so much information is being taken in that it's not even useful.
I mean, is this a sort of an international relations nightmare for Washington, or is it just widely accepted as, you know, the common practice?
I'm sure there are a lot of PR people in the government that aren't getting a lot of sleep lately, although I know that there are also a lot of surveillance attorneys both in and out of the government who aren't getting a lot of sleep and policy advocates. An issue, not because it hasn't been going on for a long time, but because it's been kept secret. And, you know, sunshine is the best disinfectant. We can look at these programs now and evaluate them, but we should have been able to do this a long time ago and to figure out what is the proper balance.
San Francisco commuters are dealing with a fourth day of strikes on the Bay Area's major rail network, known as BART. Thousands of stranded commuters took to highways, buses and ferries dawn on Monday. Negotiations between BART management and unions over pay and employee benefits have been dragging on for 6 months. With no further face-to-face talks scheduled for Monday, the paralysis looks set to continue. In a tragic twist, two BART workers were hit by a train on Saturday and killed. FSN's Daniel Wrench's got the latest from our San Francisco correspondent, Rebecca Bowring.
Well, on Saturday, two BART workers, Lawrence Daniels and Christopher Shepherd, were killed after being struck by a train near the Walnut Creek station. They'd gone to investigate a reported dip in the tracks there, and they were hit by a northbound train that was coming back from the maintenance yard. It wasn't carrying any passengers at the time because we were in the midst of a BART strike, but it was in automatic mode, being run by a computer. And media reports say it was a veteran operator at the controls. We don't know whether that means he was experienced or a former driver, because BART has reportedly been retraining some of its managers, who used to be operators, to drive passenger trains during strike periods. The unions have said that this isn't safe practice.
So we don't know at the moment whether this incident was connected to the strike and the measures that were taken?
No, federal authorities won't say whether they have detected any link as yet. They are looking into all options. The National Transport Safety Board is carrying out a full investigation, inspecting the track, looking at video clips. BART management say on their side that the incident has boosted commitment to get the strike issue resolved. But unions have been quick to say that it goes to the heart of what they've been calling for, because safety during train operations has been a major sticking point in negotiations.
And tell us about the impact that this has had on the people of San Francisco and the Bay Area as a whole.
There's total paralysis in the Bay Area. Many commuters have been leaving home 90 minutes early to try and get into the office. We've seen ferries. There are extra ferry services and extra bus services, but they are full to capacity. Huge lines of people queuing to get onto buses. Traffic was backed up on the Bay Bridge from 5:30 in the morning. And I think that commuters really resent having the weight of the shutdown come to rest on their shoulders. They resent being held to ransom over this. And it's really an embarrassment for San Francisco. It made Mayor Ed Lee delay his trip to China last week. So it even has international repercussions as well.
Do you think there is an end in sight?
No, I don't think that there's an end in sight. Today, Monday, there has been no face-to-face meeting scheduled between unions and BART management. They haven't actually met since Thursday. There is an afternoon meeting where the BART Board of Directors will look at unions' counter-offers, but it's just a constant process of to-ing and fro-ing. And let's remember that these talks actually began in April over issues to do with pay, pensions, healthcare. And we had a strike in July that dragged on for 4.5 days and required intervention from the California governor to force BART workers to get back to work. So I think that, unfortunately, at the moment, there is no end in sight.
You yourself use the BART system. Has it been a difficult commute?
Yes, it's been complicated for me too. I use BART to get from my home into my office in just south of downtown in San Francisco. I resorted to using a service where it's like a taxi service, but run by people. It's like Friends with Cars is how they market it. And there was a huge amount of competition to use that. And I had to pay a premium rate in order to be able to get one. So I had to pay 1.5 times the regular price. I've seen lots more bicycles on the roads this morning. So lots of people using San Francisco bike share as well, and carpooling. So people are trying to be as innovative as possible about how to get to work. But essentially, this is going to cause a massive impact to the economy for people's lost productivity. And the work stoppage in July was estimated to have cost $100 million every single day. So I think we're going to be counting the cost of this latest strike for some time to come as well.
FSN's Daniel Wrench is talking to Rebecca Bowring in San Francisco. An experiment in 1950s New York that used a group of homeless alcoholic men as unwitting test subjects has been making waves in the ethical community. In exchange for a few meals, men underwent prostate biopsies in the name of cancer research. But many didn't know the repercussions these surgeries would have. U.S. correspondent Rebecca Foster spoke with Jason Schwartz of Princeton University's Center for Human Values to find out just what happened during those years in the Bowery District.
So what we've heard about from these recently published papers was a research program that happened in New York City in the early 1950s, led by an academic physician who was looking to understand both the diagnosis and subsequent treatment of prostate cancer. And the way he did this was working with a group of down-on-their-luck alcoholics in the Bowery District of New York City, and he, over the course of the research, subjected them to invasive biopsies and then subsequent surgeries that were intended to provide generalizable information about what we knew about prostate cancer at the time. But in the process, the men that were used in these research trials were exposed to a substantial amount of risk, and it's unclear whether they quite knew what they were participating in. So that's the story that's really emerged over the last week or so that's caused us to think about our legacy of human experimentation here in the United States.
Can you explain to us what were the ethical implications of this experiment?
So what we've seen over the decades is the emergence of a number of protections regarding how we regulate and oversee human subjects research. And this is the kind of study that explains why those protections emerged, both in terms of, in several levels, in terms of the population, the way in which these individuals were used for the research, primarily because they were an available and convenient group to experiment on, and that surely can't happen today. The level of risk that these men were exposed to goes beyond any reasonable standard that we would allow research volunteers to participate in. The level of consent that they provided is at best ambiguous, but certainly doesn't rise to modern standards. And the scientific design of this study raised real questions about whether there was ever going to be good, valid information that came from it. And for all of those reasons, those would be the kinds of red flags that if this study were to be subjected to ethical review today, it would fail on all four of those levels.
So how is it that no one stopped this experiment from happening when it did? Were there just no such safeguards around at that point?
Right, and this is where we need to be careful about retroactively applying today's ethical standards or ethical requirements to the past. That surely that the kinds of events like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment that came to light in the 1970s, other kinds of research like this that was happening in the 50s and 60s led to the emergence of today's research oversight system. So it wouldn't be fair to say that the system failed because the system was emerging. But generally what there is a consensus that even if there aren't the exact kinds of requirements, the ethical requirements that are in place today, that there are some basic principles about how we ought to treat other individuals that are timeless, that are independent of any sort of regulatory scheme. And that's where this research falls short, regardless of when it was done or regardless of how noble or well-intended the researchers' goals were, that there are clear standards that we ought to treat other individuals with respect. We ought not to use other individuals for the gains of third parties. And that's where this research really is a clear failure in that ethical sense.
FSN's Rebecca Foster speaking with Jason Schwartz. Now, in most major U.S. cities, the housing market has recovered from the lows of the 2008 mortgage crisis, and now home prices and rents are rapidly rising while incomes remain flat. But as prices spike, low-income Americans are finding it increasingly hard to find affordable housing. In Denver, for example, a minimum wage employee must work the equivalent of 2.5 full-time jobs just to afford the average rent. FSN's Mary McCarthy reports from Denver on a project making it possible for some poor Americans to own their own homes.
Construction is well underway on this brand new pastel green townhome for single mom Saba Askadam, an immigrant to Denver from Ethiopia.
The great about it is my kids are going to have their own room. It's a 4-bedroom. And I have a basement. I'm so excited to have my own home.
Saba's home is one of 11 new houses built here by Habitat for Humanity, the charitable organization that provides affordable housing to low-income families. The homes are built largely by volunteers and sold with interest-free mortgages. Homeowners also invest hundreds of hours into building their own house and the homes of others. Saba says it's the only way she could afford to buy.
This world is scared to buy a house. I've been trying, but the mortgage is, I cannot afford this.
Even for middle-class Americans, and even with interest rates at historic lows, paying a mortgage is a challenge these days. Online real estate tracker Trulia says that for early October, in 14 of the top 100 metropolitan regions in the U.S., over half of the for sale homes have been out of reach for middle-class buyers, which means that for most low-income Americans, owning a home in those markets remains a pipe dream. Habitat for Humanity's Denver CEO, Heather Lafferty, says that projects like this one are just a drop in the bucket when it comes to addressing housing needs for the poor in a large city like Denver.
What we find are that working families are really in crisis. They are living with 12, 15 people in a two-bedroom apartment. That's not a good place for a child.
A celebrity was on site in Denver to lend a hand in construction, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter.
I think one of the basic human rights is to have a right to live in a decent home.
For decades now, President Carter and his wife Rosalynn have been calling for greater government housing assistance for the poor.
Say you're working in a McDonald's or something for minimum wage, how are you going to own a house if you don't get some direct help?
Saba and her kids are due to move into their new home in December. Meanwhile, advocates for low-income workers estimate that across the U.S., some 7 million poor families are in need of homes they can actually afford. Mary McCarthy, Denver.
Now, New Jersey has become the 14th state in the U.S. to recognize same-sex marriages. The state's governor, Chris Christie, had sought to delay the granting of marriage licenses by appealing a decision by the state Supreme Court in September. That decision held that denying same-sex couples the right to marry was a violation of the rights granted to them in June when the federal Supreme Court struck the Defense of Marriage Act. However, the court rejected the governor's appeal and ordered the state to begin allowing same-sex couples to wed. Ira Spitzer reports on the jubilant scene as the state began conducting its first same-sex marriages after the stroke of midnight on Monday.
Thank God, by the state of New Jersey, it's about time. I declare Joseph and Orville to be lawful spouses in the state of New Jersey. You may kiss your spouse!
That's Newark Mayor and U.S. Senator-elect Cory Booker officially conducting the first same-sex wedding in New Jersey. It had been a long time coming for Joseph and Orville, and it had been a long time coming for Booker as well. The mayor had previously refused to conduct any weddings until same-sex couples were granted the right to marry. By the end of the night, Booker had married 5 gay couples and 2 straight pairs. When Booker asked if anyone objected to the first wedding of the night, a protester shouted that the marriages were unlawful in the eyes of God and Jesus Christ. The protester was then removed as Booker continued the ceremony, saying he was not hearing any substantive and worthy objections. In addition to the Newark Rotunda where Booker presided, same-sex couples began marrying across the state in early morning ceremonies. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie officially dropped his appeal later in the day. Previously, Christie, who was seen to be a potential Republican candidate for president in 2016, had wanted the issue to be decided by a popular referendum instead of by the state's highest court. However, acknowledging the court's decision, Christie ordered New Jersey's Department of Health to cooperate with municipalities in issuing the marriage licenses. Ira Spitzer, New York.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the program. Our email address, reports@featurestory.com. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Tuesday, the Greenpeace activists facing 15 years in a Russian prison. That's Tuesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Rebecca Foster. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.